For decades, our society has been treating marriage and the family very badly. In fact, in the 1960s and 1970s, marriage was dismissed as unimportant, and a huge proportion of children born today are born out of wedlock. In the past few years, marriage has become very, very important, as long as it's marriage between a man and a man, or marriage between a woman and a woman. But according to the Bible, marriage is between a man and a woman. Genesis 2, 22 through 24, "Then the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man. He brought her to the man. The man said, 'This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man.' That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh." And biblical marriage is important for family. It's important for the children, and it's important for society. But we live in a disposable culture, and for decades, marriage has been viewed as disposable. In fact, almost anything is disposable now. At the turn of the 20th century, in 1901, in fact, a guy was trying to come up with an invention. Someone advised him that what he needed to devote his efforts to was something that was, number one, needed, and number two, disposable. He invented the disposable razor. His name was King Camp Gillette. What a name, King Camp Gillette. But we love disposable things. Family has been under attack from those on the left for many decades. Nothing shocking about that. There's no news there. For example, several years ago, a professor in a university in New Mexico said, "We need to get rid of the idea that a lot of people have that kids belong to their parents." Not surprising that a statement like that, of course, would come from a university professor. But popular cultural views on marriage are certainly not in harmony with the Bible. Popular cultural views on children are usually not in harmony with the Bible either. Our culture is turning things upside down regarding the family, regarding the home, regarding children, regarding parenting. The biblical model for the home is this. 1 Corinthians 11:3, "The head of every man is Christ. The head of woman is man." There are other passages that would substantiate this, but this is a very succinct passage which makes the point. And then Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." The biblical model for the home is this: Christ is over all things, man is the head of the family, and the children are in subjection to the parents. When there's a breakdown in the biblical model, at the least, it makes things much more difficult. At worst, the results are a blight on the family and a blight on society. An idea has become popular, if not prevalent, in our society over the past several decades, and it's the idea of child-centered homes. Talked a little bit about child-centered parenting this morning. The biblical model is often called the traditional model, and it's been described as parent-centered homes. A concise definition contrasting the two might be this: the child-centered approach puts the child rather than the parent at the center of the family and at the center of decision-making. Ephesians 6:4 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." Advocates of child-centered homes, child-centered parenting, believe that describes everything that's wrong with traditional parenting. I'm going to read excerpts from two articles written by Michael Mascolo, PhD, who is an author and is professor of psychology at Merrimack College in North Andover, Massachusetts. One of the articles was on the Psychology Today website. The other one was on another website. I don't recall which one. It was entitled, the article, it was written in November 2013. It's entitled, Child-Centered Parenting, Good Intentions Gone Wrong. I found it fascinating that this guy, being a professor of psychology and so forth, would write an article like this. I was quite enamored by it. He says, the child-centered approach to parenting was born of good intentions. I think he's very fair about this, too. It was meant to provide an alternative to the traditional adult-centered approach to parenting, which was considered to be overly authoritarian and indeed often included physical punishment. In the adult-centered approach, parents take the lead in setting family rules, making family decisions, and enforcing maturity demands. While there are many forms of parent-centered child-rearing, they all embrace the idea that parents have legitimate authority over their children, and thus the parents should guide and direct their children's development. If they failed, their child would become spoiled, a term which our great-grandparents may have meant quite literally. Child-centered parenting emerged as a reaction against the adult-centered approach. Although it had its origins in the progressive parenting movements of the 20s and 30s, it took hold with greater fervor after the 1960s. The child-centered approach puts the child rather than the parent at the center of decision-making. From a child-centered perspective, now what I'm going to say for the next several sentences here are from that perspective. From a child-centered perspective, children are born ready to explore the world and to learn through active discovery. It's the job of the parent to kindle rather than stifle a child's self-directed curiosity. Too much parental direction can squelch a child's initiative and damage their confidence and self-esteem. Borrowing a phrase from proponents of child-centered education, a good parent functions more like a guide on the side rather than an all-knowing sage of the stage. He says, research shows that there's a rather large paradox in child-centered parenting. Parents who emphasize loving care over high expectations tend to have more conflict in their homes than not. Let me read that again. Parents who emphasize loving care, now we would have to put that in quotes, I suppose, over high expectations tend to have more conflict in their homes than not. He says, this is because child-centered parenting often follows a predictable pattern. For example, mom will ask Nikki to clean her room, but Nikki doesn't want to. Out of love, quote, in quotes there, mom lets Nikki put off cleaning until later. Then mom asks again. Nikki promises to do it later. Finally, mom gets frustrated and screams, clean your room right now. When Nikki resists, and why shouldn't she? Why shouldn't she resist again? She's learned she doesn't have to comply with her mom's requests. Leads until she starts screaming, maybe. And then an argument brews. He says, child-centered parents love their children and want to promote their autonomy, their individuality, and creativity. Who could disagree with these values? The problem, however, is not that these are bad values. The problem is that they are one-sided values. In a well-meaning attempt to promote self-directed cooperative children, child-centered parenting fails to provide the very direction that children need to develop these skills in the first place. Children enter the world as incomplete beings. They are not little adults who can direct their own thinking, make responsible decisions, or make complex connections for themselves. It is true that children come into life with many surprising skills and abilities. However, children are nonetheless underdeveloped beings. They need adults to help complete their development. They do not begin life as self-directed, empathic, and moral beings, having empathy to be able to understand and relate to other people and their feelings and their needs. Instead, they need parental direction and guidance in order to develop into self-directed, empathetic, and moral beings. He concludes this way. Child-centered parenting runs the risk of producing entitled, narcissistic children who lack the capacity to persevere and cope with difficulty. This is because there is a fine line between being loving and being indulgent. I would follow that up with Proverbs 22:15, which says, "Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him." And Proverbs 26:12, which says, "Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for that man." A child-centered home risks giving kids the false security that the world is all about them. A child-centered home puts a strain on the marriage because it puts kids at the center of the family. A child-centered home reinforces selfishness, reinforces the idea that the world revolves around the wishes and the demands of this child. It puts a responsibility and a pressure on children that they simply were not meant to carry. It makes the kids a challenge in all other relationships and in society at large. Proverbs 29:15, really focusing on the second part of the verse. First part says, "The rod and rebuke give wisdom." So we might say training, discipline, instruction, guidance in whatever form, from the least intrusive to the most intrusive. "The rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother." You have any idea how scary it must be for a child to feel like that he is in charge of everything? That everything is in their hands? With the total lack of experience they have being at the mercy of their feelings and emotions? You ever been in an emergency situation and nobody knew what to do? Then maybe somebody with training or experience just stepped up. They took over. They started leading people. What a relief that somebody has taken charge, that somebody knows how to get us out of this mess, that somebody with strength, with knowledge and experience has stepped up to the plate. Consider the effect of these assurances in Scripture. Exodus 23, verses 23 and 24, Israel at Mount Sinai, Moses up on the mountain with God. He says, "My angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off, or I will annihilate them. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. My angel will go before you and bring you into this land." These are people out here. They haven't been here before. They haven't traveled this way before. They've not fought wars before, except for the skirmishes they previously had. They're not a military people. They're not a trained people in anything that would equip them for what they're getting ready to undertake. And you have the God of all creation telling them, "I am going to lead the way." Matthew 11, 28 through 30, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Anybody here want to be on your own in this world? No assistance from anybody else, whether man, woman, or the God in heaven, just out there making your own way, figuring it out. A child-centered family is inherently a dysfunctional family. Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 3, says, "In the last days there will be difficult times, for people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. They will be unloving and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good." Disobedient to their parents and ungrateful, unloving and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. Read this a moment ago, but I want to expand on it a minute. Just for a minute. Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof bring wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. The New American Standard Bible says a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. A child who is left to himself, who gets his own way. That's the fundamental definition of child-centered home or child-centered parenting. Now, I'm not saying a child should never get their way. It's time for dessert, and you say, we've got chocolate or we've got vanilla ice cream. Which one do you want? The child says, I want chocolate. Well, it's vanilla for you, kid. The point is not to be mean to your children, but a child who gets everything he wants is going to be a spoiled child. He won't like himself, and nobody else will like him either. One of the reasons it's important for children to submit to their parents and to obey their parents is that we are preparing them to be unselfish, unrebellious people who will submit to a higher father. If I treat my child as if the world revolves around him, I'm training my child to think that the world revolves around him and that he should get to do whatever he wants and that my job and everybody else's job is to make him happy. Then I shouldn't be surprised when he grows up and he has no respect for God and he still thinks that the world revolves around him and he thinks everybody else is supposed to make him happy. And incidentally, that describes a portion of our youth in this country right now. But the world doesn't work that way. And most of his relationships are not going to work that way. And when he gets a job, his boss is not going to work that way. Everyone else is not going to agree that the world revolves around him, and God is not going to agree that the world revolves around him. So guess when he needs to learn that the world does not revolve around him? Guess when he needs to learn that everybody doesn't exist just to fulfill his desires and make him happy. Let's take a moment to consider what we might call reality discipline. You get up one morning and you fix a bowl of cereal for each of your children. It's their favorite cereal. Every one of them just loves this cereal. But little Johnny comes in a bad mood this morning. He grumpily sits down at the table and he snubs his nose at the cereal. And you say, you need to eat your cereal, Johnny. Little Johnny says, no, I'm not going to. Well, there are different ways to deal with that. But if you want to try dealing with it in a way which prepares little Johnny for the realities of life which lie ahead, here's one thing you can try. You said you need to eat your cereal, Johnny. He says, no, I'm not going to. So with a smile on your face, you take his bowl of cereal and you swiftly dump it in the trash can. Then you smile and say, now you go on out and play. Lunch will be ready in about 5 hours. 30 minutes later, when little Johnny comes back in and says, I'm hungry. You say, I'll bet you are, Snookums. Now you go back out and play, and I'll let you know when lunch is ready. Might call that reality discipline. You don't nag. You don't tell him a half a dozen times what you're going to do. Now, if you don't eat that, I'm going to throw it in the trash. I said eat it. Now, I'm going to throw it in. Watch it. You better eat it. You simply present him with the consequences of his behavior, and you do it with a smile and with a pleasant attitude. How does this prepare little Johnny for future reality? Well, if little Johnny grows up and the boss tells everybody to come in a half hour early tomorrow and breakfast is going to be served and it's going to be free, it's going to be on the company dime. Big Johnny gets there and all they've got is bagels and coffee. And he doesn't like bagels and he doesn't like coffee. So he stubs up. Makes it clear that he's not going to eat bagels and he's not going to drink coffee. What do you think is going to be the response of his co-workers and his boss? Oh, what would you like? Let's run. I'll run to McDonald's, the boss says. I'll get you. What do you want, Johnny? No. It's going to be something like, well, that's what we got. Take it or leave it. How about when Big Johnny sees the flashing lights in his rearview mirror? And he looks down, sees that he's doing 20 miles per hour over the speed limit, and his first thought is, I don't want to pull over. Reality check. What about when Johnny's on his first job and he's just had a fight with his girlfriend, so he's in a bad mood and the boss tells him to do something, and Johnny's immediate thought is to say, I'm not going to do that, but he remembers the bowl of cereal. Part of reality parenting is a lack of nagging, a lack of I told you so. Part of reality parenting is a lack of fussing and a lack of criticizing. You ever had a police officer pull you over and say caustically, sarcastically, and pleadingly, don't you know this is a 55 speed zone? Don't you know you might get pulled over for speeding? What were you thinking? I've never been approached that way myself. How could you do this? Don't you know you have to pay a speeding ticket and maybe even have to go to a class? And he's all just upset, and they usually don't approach me that way. That's probably not going to happen. He treats you with respect. He treats you with dignity. He allows you to sit there and wallow in the fact of what an idiot you were for not paying attention to your speed or not setting your cruise control. And he does it with dignity. License and registration, please. Now, Mr. Chamberlain, and he goes, I don't know. That's what I've heard they say. He might as well have a mirror on the front of his uniform as you're sitting there looking at yourself and reflecting about what you've done. If you don't get an assignment done on time at school, do you think your teacher or your professor is constantly going to be nagging you and saying, now, you know you only got 2 days left. Have you even started on that paper yet? You know this is going to be 25% of your grade. This is going to impact your GPA. It's not the way the real world works. As much as is possible, reality discipline allows the child to simply face the consequences of his or her own behavior. It allows them to face the consequences of their own choices. Lest I give the impression that I'm implying the home should be a boot camp of sorts, a place where you hear the constant sound of whip cracking. If there is always lecturing, always complaining, always anger and nagging in the home, the children are going to seek peace and comfort and solace somewhere else. The home needs to be a safe place. The home needs to be a place where they know they will find love and peace and acceptance when they walk in those doors. The world is a harsh and cruel place. Why would we want them to experience that in our home? But if the home feels harsher and crueler than the world, then they will run to the world the first chance they get. And if they've never felt accepted and loved and cherished and treasured at home, they will flee to the first guy or the first girl or the first drink or the first drug or the first something else that makes them feel that way. This brings up another issue I failed to address in 102. By the way, the title that I didn't have a PowerPoint tonight is Parenting 103. We did 101 4 weeks ago. We did 102 last Sunday night. And in 102, I talked about an actual account regarding a boy sleeping in the mornings, and the mother constantly nagging him to get up and get ready for school. We're going to be late. Come on, come on. And how she learned to do differently than that and just leave him in bed and let him stand on his own 2 feet. When you treat a child that way, nagging them, berating them, you are teaching them that they are irresponsible. You are teaching the child that he is incompetent. You're teaching the child that you have no confidence in him, that you don't think he has the strength of character to be responsible and to stand on his own 2 feet. It's a pretty bad message to be sending a child. When you think of it that way, when you step back and you look at what you're actually doing, it is not the message the parent wants to send. It is not the message the parent is trying to send, but it is the message that's being sent. and it's the message that's being received. Child-centered parenting is an extreme, and the problem with extremes is that they always produce a result that is just as bad as the one they're trying to avoid. They always produce a result that's just as bad as the one they're trying to run from. Problem with extremes in parenting is that they always lead to rebellious children. When parents are too lenient, the result is rebellious children. When parents are overly controlling, overly harsh, overly critical, the result is always rebellious children. All parents make mistakes. All parents have faulty ideas, faulty thinking. It is extremely rare for a parent not to love their children deeply. Virtually all parents love their children. But we brought our own baggage into the relationship, and that baggage gets pulled out every time we face a conflict with our children. I said this in a previous lesson. This is not just a lesson about parenting. If I'm to be the husband I should be, I must fix myself first. If I'm to be the best employee I should be, I must fix myself first. If I'm to be the best parent I should be, I must fix myself first. You can try to teach your kids, train your kids, fill their heads with all kinds of knowledge, but if you are a mess, if you've got tons of baggage, and if you're not trying to fix your own mess, that will come through in everything you say. It will come across in your attitude. It will come across in how you treat your children. If you have no confidence in yourself, it will show when you have conflicts with your children. If you have unresolved anger, it will show when you have conflicts with your children. If you have no convictions about morality issues, it will be made manifest when you have conflicts with your children. If you're out of control, it will become clear when you have conflicts with your children. If you have to be in control of everything and everyone in your life, it will show when you have conflicts with your children. Since we all have baggage, that sounds pretty bleak. That's why the only way that we can ensure that we're being the best parent that we can be is to be humbly seeking to be the best Christian we can be. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Accept Christ's love. Accept Christ's grace. Then pour out that love and pour out that grace on your children.